Today on Maine Calling, the wisdom of David McCullough, why history matters, an encore presentation. Renowned and beloved author David McCullough died 3 years ago, but his towering books about American history live on. Two of them, biographies of Presidents Truman and John Adams, received the Pulitzer Prize. Of course, PBS viewers know McCullough's voice as the longtime narrator of the show American Experience. And many people here in Maine had the privilege of meeting him when he spent time at his home in Camden. David McCullough said, "Indifference to history isn't just arrogant, it's rude." I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our earlier conversation on McCullough's philosophy about the lessons of history with his daughter and his longtime researcher. They've collaborated on a new book collecting some of McCullough's previously unpublished essays, speeches, and more. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. David McCullough won many prizes for his books about American history, but he wasn't just a book author. For many people, he was the voice of American history and an important public person, defending and amplifying what he saw as American values. Today, we'll be discussing McCullough's life and approach to work with his daughter, Dory McCullough Lawson, and Michael Hill, McCullough's longtime researcher. Together, they edited a brand new book that contains a collection of essays, speeches, and other interviews and other writings. It is called History Matters. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for this lovely book. Dory, reading the essays and speeches, it seems to me that your father was consistent in his deep belief in certain American values. Talk to me about what he valued for our country and as a person.
He was consistent, and going through his papers, it was so clear that he was consistent throughout his life. He believed strongly in what he called the primary values. It's what he lived by. The subjects that he was interested in were people who were also interested in these values, or trying to live up to them, not necessarily always, but striving to. And old verities, I would say. And they are courage, respect for other people, courtesy, self-reliance, and a devotion to truth, loathing of hypocrisy, and the power of simple goodness. And that's a sort of a paragraph that I found, a list of what he thought of as the primary values and old verities. I would add to that work. He was very, very proud of work. He was proud of the work that Americans do and have done. And he work. I mean, he worked so hard, and he really lived by that. And I would also add gratitude. He thought that gratitude was one of our most important characteristics to express and values to cherish, and how we needed to be grateful for everything we have in this country because it came from other people's work and their creative drive and their effort.
I have to ask you, Dory, these are his publicly stated values, what he valued about America. Was that what he was like as a dad? Is that what he valued?
Absolutely. There were no sides to him, none. What you saw everywhere out in the world was him. He was consistent, and I think maybe the parts that you didn't see as much that we would see as a father or a person that you would be around daily was how much fun he was. He was very, very funny, and cherished humor. tremendously. Anybody who was funny, he wanted to be around. And he was a lot of fun.
Did you all talk about history at the dinner table or not really? Did he keep that in the office?
No. All the time. All the time. I remember when he wrote Mornings on Horseback, which was the early life biography of Theodore Roosevelt. And that book came out when I was in the eighth grade. And all of his books took years to do. And I finally was able to read it. And I got to the chapter about the Roosevelt family's trip down the Nile. And I thought that that was going to be 300 pages because we had been hearing about the Roosevelt family trip down the Nile forever at the dinner table. And he talked every night we would hear about what happened that day in the office.
Wow. Wow. And I want to bring Mike into the conversation, but I'm just so curious, Dory, and maybe this is too personal a question, but was it hard to live up? I mean, he was spending all his time with these remarkable Americans as one of his kids. Did you feel like you had a pretty high bar to meet?
I would say we had a pretty high bar to meet sort of, you know, morally that my parents even, you know, they died when I was 53 and I would say, you know, 4 days before they would say, be a good girl. And to my brothers, they're in their 60s, be a good boy. I mean, to be good was important. But no, not like to live up to. They were, both of my parents, just encouraging and proud of whatever we were interested in and what we were doing. And no, I didn't feel any of that pressure to live up to it, except to be good. Be good.
Well, Mike, speaking about pressure, I can't even imagine. I've been trying to get my head around what it meant to be David McCullough's researchers because, you know, these are long books. They have a lot of detail. And speaking of pressure, did you feel that? Maybe I'll ask a more open-minded question or open-ended question. What was it like to work with David McCullough on one of his projects?
Well, Jennifer, it was extraordinary. It was not only fascinating and interesting, the whatever subject he was writing about, but it was so much fun to do it. And just to echo some of the things that Dory said, he was thinking all the time. If he wasn't writing, he was thinking. And I found recently a letter he sent me. It was a 3-page handwritten letter while he was working on Greater Journey. And in that letter, he explained why he thought bringing the artist Mary Cassatt into the story at that point was going to be a good idea and what he wanted me to look at and so forth. The other thing was that he was endlessly curious about everything. And the diversity of his interests were amazing. He was not only interested in what he was working on or writing about or who he was writing about at the moment, but he was interested in music. He was a wonderful artist, and the end sheets of the book show two paintings, one of the house in Martha's Vineyard and the other of his office out back. He loved to sing. He was interested in science and technology. He was interested in everything. And the other thing that, real quick, that he used to do, which I loved and I thought was wonderful, was he would get to a certain point in his book where, if it still existed, he wanted to go see the real place he had just written about. He wanted to go see where John and Abigail Adams lived. He wanted to go see where the Wright brothers did their test, where they lived. He wanted to go see St. Gaudens sculpture studio. He wanted to go to England to see where the Adamses lived there. And it was just wonderful. And he always picked up little tidbits along the way that would add so much to each book.
I'd love to add something there about the visiting places. One of the scenes that he liked to talk about often was doing a run through the Capitol, which was the Capitol building, which is what Harry Truman had done at the time of Franklin Roosevelt's death. And he arranged to do this and to do the run through the Capitol. And he learned a lot, not only about the route, but about what kind of person Harry Truman must have been by doing that. But from a writing standpoint, I find this fascinating and different. He would write, say, that scene in the book. He would write the scenes. He would write the chapter of the book first. And then he would go to the place to see what he got wrong. He wouldn't go to the place and then write about it. He would write first, and he was looking for what he'd done wrong. And that sort of that temperament and that confidence always interests me and impressed me, not looking for what you did right, looking for what you did wrong and correcting it.
And the fact that he wrote it and then corrected it, he was not going on to a computer or a word processor and deleting sentences, was he, Dory?
No, he did everything on a typewriter. He wrote all of his books on a Royal Standard typewriter that he bought used. And he wrote on yellow second sheets, which are like newsprint. And they became very hard to find, that paper. But he was and he got nervous at one point where he thought it was going to be unavailable. But he was able to find a supplier of this exact yellow paper. And so it would start out on the yellow paper. And he, you know, everything was in his hands and tactile. And he would bring everything into the house. And in the early mornings, I would get up early, and he would be up early too. We were the two early people in our family. And he would always be sitting in the living room with the yellow pages, crossing things out and writing in the margins. And he said that he was not a writer, but a rewriter. And they went through many, many, many iterations and eventually made it onto white paper.
And for anyone in the audience who has not read his biography of Harry S. Truman, it is more than 1,000 pages long. So he's doing this for really, really long books. But Mike, I want to talk to you about the new book, and congratulations, just out yesterday, History Matters. Why was it important for you to collect these speeches and interviews and essays? I understand many were previously unpublished. But why is this collection especially important to you to bring to the rest of us?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One, I think in terms of a large perspective, is that with the 250th anniversary of the nation's birth coming up, the section in the beginning of the book, Why History, we thought would be particularly relevant because it provides a lot of David's observations and reflections on the importance of history, the lessons that we can derive from history. And in one respect, we thought it might be nice to put all of these together, that maybe as we approach the anniversary, people will take a moment to read those pieces, to reflect on some of the values that he talks about in those pieces. So there was that element. The other was, reflect some of the things that people might not necessarily know about him. And one example is the piece about Thomas Aikens. It's one of my favorite in the whole book, but it showed that sense of David as an artist. And one thing that I remembered about going on research trips with him was that when he went to the real place, he would go look at the place at sunrise and sunset because he wanted to see how the light impacted whatever place that he happened to be writing about. The Ohio River, when he did Pioneers, was a perfect example. He wanted to see the river sunrise and sunset to see how the light was, because it was a major character in the book. The other thing that I think is really great about the book is that it's a wonderful book for aspiring writers. The final section of the book on writing gives some wonderful anecdotal stories from David about how hard writing is, but also how wonderfully enjoyable it can be. And there's some wonderful anecdotes in there about how to approach it. And the other that I really loved is that he did a speech at the National Book Festival in which he gave this list of recommended books, not only books that influenced him when he was young, but also books that he thought aspiring writers, whether it be novelists or historians or writers of historical fiction, should read. So there's a lot in there that we hope to convey for a whole variety of reasons about him and his interests.
All right. Well, I had the privilege of interviewing your father, Dory, in 2017 here on Maine Calling. And I wanted to play a couple clips from that interview. The first is I had asked him, I had noticed that he seems to like to amplify unsung heroes. And I mentioned that, and here's what he had to say.
I like to give credit where credit is long overdue. And for example, I've taken great pride and enjoyment from writing about so many of the women who were never quite out of the shadows, or who were in the wings, if you will, on stage. They deserve to be front and center on stage much of the course of the story or the book. Abigail Adams, for example, Catherine Wright, the sister of the Wright brothers, she was a phenomenal woman. And I don't think they would have succeeded with their mission to fly get into the sky without her. Emily Roebling, who was the wife of Washington Roebling, the man who made possible the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, when he was felled by the bends and unable to get out and be on the job site, she would go and she would deal with the problems that were at hand. And it's been very gratifying to be able to give those people the moment in the limelight that they've long deserved.
Tori, when I listened back to that piece of sound from your father, it reminded me of something that I was reading in the book that you all just published, which was how important your mother was to your father. And so I'm wondering if you thought the same thing as you were listening to your dad talk about the women who were in the background, but equally as important to these famous men.
Yes, I do. And I think particularly his portrayal of Abigail Adams, reading that book, I could see my mother very much in the character of Abigail. She made it possible. We all agree. He agreed. She was behind him in every way from when he took the leap to become a writer full time, which was a big risk at the time that they did it. And it was not easy. It was a struggle for them for many, many years. And I would say it wasn't until Truman came out, which was in 1992, and he'd been at it for a long time, that things sort of felt like they got rolling. But yes, she took care of all of so many things for him, but she also was, he listened to her about his writing truly more than he listened to anybody else. And it had to be good for her. And she was very, very diplomatic and careful. And her criticism, if it was negative, was presented in such a way that it didn't even seem negative, but he knew it was. And he would be so frustrated with himself because he wanted it to be right for her. She listened, he read everything. She read everything that he wrote out loud to him. And many times, and there would be days and days and days of them sitting in the living room with her reading everything out loud to him, because he wanted to write for the ear as well as for the eye.
Wow. Well, we are talking with Dory McCullough Lawson, and we are talking with Michael Hill, David McCullough's longtime researcher, about their new book, History Matters. Well, not really their new book. It's David McCullough's new book, History Matters, a collection of speeches and essays and interviews that have not been published until today. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are learning about the late author and historian David McCullough and his outlook on American history. My guest today, Dori McCullough Lawson, who is the daughter of David McCullough, and also with us, Michael Hill, David McCullough's longtime researcher. Together, they have edited the new book, History Matters. We've pulled one more piece of sound from that 2017 interview I had with David McCullough, and you'll hear my question. But it's interesting to me listening to this because this interview was 8 years ago, but I could be asking him if he were alive this question today.
I'm wondering, though, about your response to what seems to be going on in our country right now, almost a celebration of ignorance, a land of fake news and alternative facts. Are you as discouraged about that as many other people are?
Well, I'm not discouraged. I'm outraged. It makes me angry. It makes me want to stand up, at which in the way I'm doing with this book, and say, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Let's pull ourselves together and realize what kind of bad habits and acceptable, unacceptable behavior we're falling into. And that this isn't who we are. This isn't how we got here. Modesty, telling the truth, tolerance, kindness, courtesy, and empathy, putting yourself in another person's place, never getting too big for your britches, all the things that most of us grew up learning at home before we even went to school. And let's not forget that. And to think that it's sort of cool to be dishonest or vulgar or crude is a sharp turn and decline in civilization of a kind that we must not and will not take.
Dori, that was 8 years ago. What would he say today?
The same thing. He would be, I believe, outraged and think that we are in an emergency. He also, I think that it's a very difficult question. What would he say? And my temptation is to say, you know, all kinds of things, but I want to be very careful and return to things that he did say. He did say that we can't expect politicians to solve all of our problems. The country belongs to us. It is our country. It's the people's country. And what kind of country do we want?
And Michael, one of the values I'm learning from this book is he got really frustrated when people would say that they don't like living in today, that they would rather go back to when it was simpler. And David McCullough fought against this idea that it used to be simpler.
Yeah, he did. And his point was that they had their adversities. They didn't have a lot of the benefits that we have today, and that they had a lot of difficult times that they had to overcome themselves. David says at one point that it's good for us to know in our present time their own kind of hell that they went through. And his reason for saying that was that in our current times, difficult times, David says that history can provide an aid to navigation in perilous times. That if we remember that America has gone through difficult times before, that if we do what we do best, and David used to always say, we're at our best as Americans when we work together, when we live up to what our values of the past, the verities, as Dori talked about, of hard work, adversity, courage in the face of difficulties. There's a great line from David in the book where he says, if we want to make a better country, if we're serious about it, we would do well to begin with a few simple lessons from the past. And those are these lessons that Dory has talked about and that David would talk about, is that remember what they went through. Remember the essentially good nature of the American character, and it'll help us get through difficult times.
An email here from, oh, go ahead, Dory.
Well, I was just going to say, he on that, your question, Jennifer, he also talked about when you think about the past, don't think about it. No one lives in the past. Everyone lives in their own present. And that people in the past were living in their present. They were not, as he said, riding along on horses saying, oh, aren't we quaint in our powdered wigs? And isn't this wonderful living in a simpler time? They were living in their own present. It's past to us, but we're all living in our own present.
An email here from Susan. Many years ago, I wrote a fan letter to David McCullough, care of his publisher. I was so thrilled to get a handwritten letter back from him, thanking me and describing the book he was working on at the time, The Pioneers. I've kept this letter ever since. It is a prized memento. Please let his kids know how much I valued their father and his work.
Thank you so much. He came to receive a lot of fan mail, and he tried to write to everybody. It meant so much to him, and he thought that if people took the time to write to him, he really wanted to show his appreciation.
An email from Bill in Camden. I had the opportunity to speak with David a couple of times on the streets of Camden, he and his cherished Tiny Morris Minor station wagon. He had just published Truman, and we had a delightful conversation on that man. He struck me as a caring, deliberate listener, a good man. So Mike, this has come up before, that he was a listener, even though he was the famous author, the famous historian. In this collection that you have compiled, it seems as though he was just as interested in the person he was meeting as he was in sharing what he'd learned.
Oh, absolutely. I remember being with him at times on trips, research trips or whatever, where somebody would come by to the table to say hello. And David would chat with them for as long as they wanted to. And I particularly remember several times where history students would come up to David and introduce themselves, and he would talk to them. And I remember one occasion in New York City where he invited the student to sit down, and they chatted for the longest time about history, the importance of history, what he wanted to know, what they were working on and such. The other point of that too is in the research process, David did something that I think some other historians don't do, is he wanted to engage the archivists, the curators, the historians, the librarians into his process. He wanted everybody to know what he was working on. And if I had a dollar for every time that he asked a question and a librarian or archivist would say, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years and nobody's ever asked that question before. It was extraordinary. And it energized those people because they were partners in the process. And it was all just part of David's endless curiosity about things, but as you said, about people. And he was a wonderful conversationalist. He was such a joy to spend time with. Funny, interesting, curious, everything. And he could talk about anything because he was interested in everything.
Mike, I have to ask you, how did you come to work with David McCullough as his researcher?
Well, I was working up on Capitol Hill as a press secretary, and I had gotten to the point where I pretty much reached the bottom of the learning curve on that. And I wanted to do something else with my life. And I'd always been interested in history. So I happened to be reading Great Bridge. And after I finished that, I ran out and got Mornings on Horseback. And I was so taken by the way that he wrote and how it just excited me to read that I thought, well, if I could change my life, I would work for a guy like this for nothing. So I found out he lived on Martha's Vineyard. I sent him a letter, figured I'd never hear anything back. And then about a month later, I got a letter back from him one day saying that he and his family were moving to Washington because he was working on a book about Harry Truman. And he said, give me a call at this number and we'll get together and such. So I, of course, called him first thing the next day. We had lunch and we had a wonderful, wonderful lunch. And he said, I've tried some researches before and they haven't worked out, but your letter sounded nice, so let's give it a try. So he would give me these little assignments where I would moonlight and that. And then about every other weekend, he would invite me over to the house. And it was like this tutorial where he would ask me how I had done on the question. And then he would ask me a question, did you look at this? And of course, I hadn't looked at that. But over time, it helped us develop this process in which we were able to work together. But it was an extraordinary experience, and it never stopped being interesting or fun during the 40 years that we worked together. And it was great fortune.
Can you remember what one of those questions was? One of those test questions?
Yeah, he actually he was working on Truman then, and he asked me, because I was up on Capitol Hill and so forth, he asked me if I had looked at a particular diary that he was aware of at the Special Collections. And of course, I didn't know enough about Truman at that point. I didn't, but I did. And I found some little tidbits for him. And then there was some clipping collection that I didn't know anything about. And he asked me if I was aware of it, and I didn't. And he said, well, go look at it and see if you can find some things, which I did. And I found some little tidbits and so forth. So it was a great learning experience. And we had such a good time in the archives. And it was great, great good fortune. Blessed.
Dory, Mike mentioned that he moved the family to Washington to work on a book. How often did you move growing up?
Twice. I moved. I'm the youngest of five. And so I was the only one who went to Washington with my parents. We, in my childhood, they lived in New York, and then we moved to Vermont. And then Martha's Vineyard was our home. We went for 1 year to New Mexico when he was working on the Theodore Roosevelt biography. He was very interested in asthma and the asthmatics who would go to New Mexico for their health. And so we went for 8 months to New Mexico. And then we went to Washington when I was 15. And he was became the host of Smithsonian World, which was a PBS television series. And I remember the dinner table conversations about Mike's letters. And when we didn't know Mike, and, you know, I was 14 or 15 years old, and this guy in Washington has written to me, and he'll work for free. And we kids sitting around the table, he'll work for free. What is that? We couldn't believe it. And so eventually Dad thought, I'm going to give this guy a try. He did start paying Mike at one point, but Mike has been a full part of the operation in our whole family for a long time.
That's a great story. We are talking about David McCullough, his new book, History Matters, is a posthumous collection of essays and letters and speeches. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're discussing the life and work of one of this country's great writers and historians, David McCullough, who also happened to live part-time in Maine. My guests are Michael Hill and Dory McCullough Lawson. Michael is David McCullough's longtime researcher and Dory, his youngest child. And they together collaborated and edited a new collection of essays and speeches and interviews called History Matters. Mike, one thing I learned from this book is, and I believe this is part of an interview with the Paris Review, is that for a while, David McCullough was working on a book about Picasso, Pablo Picasso, but it never came to be. Tell us why not.
Well, he was working on that prior to when I hooked up with David. But I've heard the story. And the story was that he had been working on the book for about a year and done some interviews and so forth. And one day he just realized that he did not like Pablo Picasso. He just didn't like him as a person. And he decided that he didn't want to spend the next couple of years of his life writing a book about somebody that he didn't like. So he called his editor and explained to him, And they had a meeting and there was a discussion about what to do next. And the book that came out of that discussion was the Harry Truman book.
Aha. So, you know, it all worked out all right for us. Yeah. Dory, does that mean that he liked Harry Truman, that he liked John Adams, that he liked others that he wrote about?
Yes, he didn't like everything about them. He wasn't, you know, overboard about it. But I think that time, which I remember well, the Picasso time, was a really difficult time for him when he was deciding and struggling with that. He described working in a subject or with a character from history as you're living with someone as your roommate, because they were with him all the time. And he did like to write about people who he would want to be roommates with for years. And so, yes, he did. He admired Harry Truman. He admired John Adams, certainly.
We'll go to Buddy, who's calling from Gardner. Hi, Buddy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Yes, I had the occasion to meet Mr. McCullough at a bookstore in Camden when the Wright brothers, I can't let this show go not mentioning the Wright brothers. He took the time, I brought four books, and he took the time to sign his name to each of my grandsons who I bought a book for. And he took his time. He asked me if they were Americans. I was a little taken back by that question, but I said, yes, sir, they are. And he was just as charming and as wonderful. I'm holding that book in my hand as I speak. But The Wright Brothers is just one of my favorite books.
Well, thank you, Buddy, for that. Mike, is that one you worked on with him?
It was, and it was a terrific experience. To circle back on something before that we talked a little bit about, was that I remember very early on that he realized that Catherine Wright was an essential part of that that whole family equation, and we spent a lot of time going through tons of her letters, which had never been published before. And they were extraordinary. And when he went through those, he realized how important she was to the whole process. And the other thing was that, again, part of his technique was that we went to Kitty Hawk and saw where the test was there. We went where they did one of the control tests outside of Dayton. We went to see where the house is. It was moved up to Dearborn, Michigan, to the Henry Ford Museum up there, where the house was taken and reconstructed. And he was astounded as to how small the house was. The workshop was up there. We went to Paris and went to Le Mans, where they did one of the first public tests there. So that book was a perfect example of the various aspects and his views of taking on a subject.
Buddy, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Brunswick and Brian. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for this program and the two guests you have. I met David McCullough in Panama through a friend who was the head of the hydrological division. I had dropped by the Pedro Miguel locks on the Panama Canal to have a conversation with Frank Robinson, and he introduced me to David. When David found out that my work was to set up the national parks which protect the upper Panama Canal watershed, and parenthetically through a USAID project, we fell into a half-hour conversation about what I did and how we were doing on the project, and he was fascinating. We could have kept the conversation going all day, but what a wonderful man. Thank you.
Brian, thanks for that call. Dory, you're not surprised at all, are you?
I'm not. I'm wondering what year that was, if you remember.
Oh, probably around 1984 or 85.
Okay. So he was probably there at that time as part of the Smithsonian World Series that he was doing. I'm not surprised at all. He strongly believed and told everybody that would listen to him that every single person you meet, no matter who they are, what their job is, where they're from, that you can learn something from every person that you meet. And what it takes is for you to be curious and then for you to really listen to what they're saying and then lead to more curiosity. And so I know that he loved meeting you and talking to you and learning about what you were working on.
Brian, thanks so much for calling in. We have an email here from Melissa. Do you think your father would undertake a book on Donald Trump if he were still with us? Dory?
No.
Mike, you agree?
Yes.
And it's interesting to me, Dory, because your father was not registered with a political party, right? He tried to come at things from the perspective of an American first, but not a partisan, correct?
Yes, he was nonpartisan. He was recognized and awarded, you know, major awards by presidents of both parties. And he also felt, as a historian, he strongly felt that it took 50 years for time to settle and to have perspective on someone. And so he wouldn't undertake a subject that wasn't 50 years in the past, at least.
Mike, was he at work on another topic when he died, another subject? If he had been able to beat Father Time, what would he have written about next?
Good question. I don't, and maybe Dory can chime in that he might have had some, but I don't remember. I do remember, though, over the course of our association, that there were several projects that he talked about, and we would spend a little bit of time on. It's interesting. He talked every once in a while about he wanted to write a play about Emily Roebling. Because she thought she was such a fascinating character. And he thought that writing a play about her and her role in the building of the Brooklyn Bridge would make a wonderful, wonderful play. There was some discussion at one point after, I think it was after 1776, that he was thinking about doing a book of, it was tentatively called New York Rising, where it would have been a history of New York City from before the 20th century, latter part of the 20th century, 19th century, going into the eve of World War I. He had talked a little bit about that. He talked every once in a while about doing a biography of the city of Pittsburgh because it had so many wonderful elements in it. And he also discussed, before he did Wright Brothers, there was some initial discussion about he was going to do kind of a sequel to Greater Journey and pick up with the Wright brothers in the early part of the 20th century and take it through to the Lindbergh's landing in 1927 and use aviation as kind of the arc for that story. But when he got into the Wright brothers, he got so captivated by their story, Catherine's story, by the father's story and so forth, that he felt he just wanted to focus on their story. So he was always thinking about different things and so forth. So it was made it endlessly fascinating because we'd spend time working on a subject that he might not undertake. But as he said, nothing was ever wasted.
I'll jump in a little bit. Near the end of his life, he had, and this was typical throughout, but very close to the end of his life, he had a list of book ideas that I think was 27 ideas for books that he wanted to do.
Oh my goodness. Do you remember any of them, Dory?
Some of what Mike is talking about, he thought, I do. I remember a book about Congress. He very much wanted to do a book about writing. And he did, he always had, this wasn't new. He always had ideas for novels and plays and, it wasn't all history that he was thinking about. History was his subject, but he thought of himself and he lived and he thought his mind worked as a writer more than a historian. And a writer is what he wanted to be. And that's the way he was.
Well, we can't let this speaking of writers, we can't let this program end without asking you, Mike, about the biography that you wrote about Elihu Washburn. You wrote a biography of a Mainer.
I did. I'm glad you asked that question, too, because we spent, well, that came about because when David was doing Greater Journey, he got to the point in the story where he thought, how are we going to tell the Franco-Prussian War and the siege and the commune through an American's eyes. And he told me to go find out who the American ambassador was. And I found out that it was Elihu Washburn. And then we found out that a lot of his papers were at the Library of Congress. And they were incredible. They were incredible. He kept a diary and letters and letter books were there. And that, and then we spent a lot of time. We went up to Livermore to see the house up there. And we went up there 3 or 4 times, I believe. But then in the, there's a library, a separate building there. And in the basement there was another huge archive that we didn't know about. And we found a ton of other original documents there, which David used for the Washburn story. And then after Greater Journey came out, David very kindly went to Simon & Schuster and asked if they would approach me about doing a book just about Elihu Washburn to expand the story a little bit more. And I was very hesitant because I had never written anything. And I told David, I said, I don't think I can do it. And he said, yes, you can. I have total confidence in the fact that you can. And that gave me the courage to take it on. And it was great fun. And he was wonderful during the whole process. And he wrote a wonderful foreword to the book.
Boy, that's
but it's a great story.
Yeah. So he said, yes, you can. Yes, you can write a book.
He did. I really didn't think I could do it. It really, but he was so good about it. And he said, I know you can do it. And I remember when I finished the manuscript and I sent it to him because he wanted to read it before he wrote the foreword. And he finished it, I guess, on a Saturday, and he called me up and I was so terrified. And he said, Mike, I'm so, so proud of you. And it was one of the great moments of my life.
Mm. Well, we can't go then. We have a little less than 2 minutes. What should Maine people know about Elihu Washburn that they may not?
Well, I think the one of the biggest things is the fact that his time in Paris as the American ambassador. And what happened was, is when the Franco-Prussian War broke out, every diplomat, foreign diplomat, except for Washburn, left Paris because of the danger was posed to it, because they thought, they were pretty sure the Germans were going to end up taking over the city. But he stayed because he wanted to help protect with his diplomatic immunity any French Parisian treasures that were there. But also he wanted to help any of the, there were German residents still there, and he wanted to do whatever he could to try and protect them. And then what happened was that the Germans couldn't get in, the city was under siege, and there was the horrible conditions that he had to live in, that they ran out of food, they ended up having to kill horses and eat horses, they were eating rats. It was absolutely, absolutely horrible. But he never once considered leaving. There's wonderful letters where he wrote to his wife and son who did, he sent them to safety. And he said, I will never leave here because this is my duty to stay here and do whatever I can to represent the United States and to protect whatever and whoever I can. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the greatest part of it that I think should know. He was a wonderful friend of Abraham Lincoln's and U.S. Grant. He was actually partially responsible for U.S. Grant being ultimately put in charge of the.
I have to wrap you up, Mike, but it is fitting that we're ending with a conversation about somebody who was very courageous, because that clearly courageous people were who your father, Dory, David McCullough, liked to write about. I really appreciate the time both of you gave us today. Michael Hill, David McCullough's longtime researcher, and Dory McCullough Lawson, his daughter. Both of them together have edited a new book called History Matters, David McCullough's essays, speeches, and some other writings. Today's sound engineer, Chris Bridges, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.